So, I would like to answer some of the questions that came in writing, and I couldn't answer them yesterday. I answered some of the questions, but still some are left. So this is coming from Henry Becker of Germany. Everlasting poverty, a bodhisattva refusing to grow up for the benefit of all. How shall this work? I do wonder after all. I think this is a translation problem, probably. There's nothing called everlasting poverty. There is something called yonarjorva. It means like ever young or ever youthful. This is to indicate that bodhisattvas are always like with the same kind of courage and energy and activity, that they never decay, or their energy and determination and compassion and activities never decrease or decay or weaker like that. That's the Kumara in Sanskrit, means like youthful. Maybe that was kind of a little bit translated in this little bit strange way. And so I think that's enough for the. Then there's another translation, another question from Maggie Jones, and here it says, I read, I cannot remember where this phrase which has stayed with me. Keep your mind in the ultimate, but your actions in the relative. For me, it seems the answer, but please could Rinpoche comment. Well, this is like this, you know. When we try to study and practice Dhamma, we look at the nature of things, and we find that everything is impermanent, everything is interdependent, everything changes, and not only that, but if you look deeply, there is nothing existing on its own. Everything is like a dream, like a mirage, like a rainbow. So that's the view. So to understand that is very important, because if you understand that yourself, what we call self, I am, you know, we have this very strong sense of, you know, me, and I'm afraid, I want this, I hate this, I don't want this, I like this, I don't like this, you know, too much of self kind of, you know, something will happen to me, something, you know, I don't like these people because I think they are not very good for me, or they don't like me, or things like that. So all these are coming from that self-grasping, self-centeredness. So therefore also, because if I see everything around me as truly existing, because it's, then I get too much attached to them, or I get too much aversion to them. So therefore, if I understand this view, if I understand this reality, this truth, then I could have less aversion, less attachment, less self, you know, self-clinging or self-grasping, more kind, more compassionate, more kind of broad-minded. You know? So therefore this view is very much encouraged and very much important and a very, very kind of important part of the meditation and reflection also. But sometimes this kind of creates a problem by saying that everything is impermanent, everything is emptiness. Then you kind of go into a different wrong way. Oh, everything is emptiness, it doesn't matter. So if somebody is suffering, it doesn't matter, it's all emptiness. You know, it doesn't, they don't really exist. So you don't have compassion, you don't help, you don't. And also if you do something not so nice, not so right, not so good, it doesn't matter because everything is emptiness like that. So therefore it is very, very bad, because with that view, then I've not that view in order to bring more compassion and more kindness and less aversion and attachment, you know, turns into nihilism and carelessness, uncaring. And of course, you know, although the things don't exist in a very direct, solid way, or they are all interdependently there, and they are all, you know, they don't exist as something truly existing. But everything happens according to cause and conditions. Everything is interdependently arising. So, you know, interdependently, you know, you have whatever you sow, so you reap. It's not because they are intrinsically there, they are truly existing. But because they are not truly existing, therefore anything can appear, and because of causes and conditions, things can happen. So suffering can happen, happiness can happen, you can harm, you can help, you know, and all these, the karmic things, you know, it's very true, it's happening. It's relatively true, but it's completely true, truly happening, truly experienced. So that's a danger. That is a danger of this view of emptiness. So therefore, it is said that if you have a wrong way of looking at the view of emptiness, then it could do you more harm than help. That's the understanding. So therefore, you know, however high or deep your view is, it's not really to say that, you know, keep your mind in the ultimate, but action in the relative. It is, maybe you can say that also, but usually we say, let your view can be very high and deep, but your action has to be very, what can you say, minute, very careful, you know. It's not that, actually these two has to go together, and if you see these two things together, if you understand these two as not contradiction but completely, you know, as part of one thing, then you understand. Then you understand the philosophy of Madhyamaka. Then you understand the Buddhist way of doing. Because, you know, everything is interdependently happening, relatively happening. And there is no denying that. And nobody can stop that. So whatever causes and conditions are there or created, that result will happen, whether you like it or you don't like it. And why it's happening like that? Because there is nothing, you know, solid. There's nothing, one thing totally, intrinsically true and real. Therefore, even one little cause or condition can change, can create things differently, can make things, you know. So therefore, you know, the more you understand the view of emptiness and the deeper meaning and deeper, higher level of ultimate nature, the more you also understand how the relative appearance happens, and you become more careful. So therefore, the more you understand the emptiness, the more you will become very careful about the karmic actions, you know, how the karmic effect will be. So this is, you know, this is important, and that's why it is said like this. And this is said everywhere, you know, in all the teachings. Okay, then next question is, could you explain what cause and condition mean in a general way, please? Generally speaking, not with examples, what does it mean for a phenomena to be the cause, the condition of another one? What's the difference? Does a phenomena necessarily have one cause and several conditions, or can there be several causes in addition to the conditions? Is there any literature you would recommend on this topic? Yes, there are lots of literature, and it's very important. Really, you have to study this. There is what we call the 6 causes, 4 conditions, 5 results. And this cause are hetu, and pratitya, chen, in the condition, and then results. So this is very important part, and this is discussed in Abhidharma, Abhidharma Kosha also, and then also in Buddhist logic, it's in great detail, and lots of debates also. Then there is one book by Mipham Rinpoche called Kenjuk, Gateway to the, I don't know what they call it, to scholarship or something like that, Kepal and Jukpa, entering into wise or wisdom. I don't really remember the actual translation. You have there a little bit, it's a short, but not so unclear, I think. There is English translation also, you should read, but it is really the causes, you know, there are many, you know, it's talking about interdependence. Actually, it's talking about interdependence. You know, there are many causes. Many causes means like, maybe this is something a little bit not the way it's usually talked about in the world, you know, in other studies. The cause is not just, you know, like the seed is the cause of the, you know, fruit. Say you seed, you sow the seed, and then things, you know, like a tree or flower or fruit grows. But that's just one cause, you know, one of the causes. You know, so the conditions are like, there should be rain, there should be, you know, sunlight, there should be all these things, but there are also many different other conditions. Now, this is one cause, is the seed. But there's another causes, because, you know, just the seed wouldn't work, because there are lots of elements there, like, you know, to have something growing, you need many elements. You know, anything living has to have at least four elements, or five elements, you know. There should be a water element, there should be fire element, there should be wind element, and there should be earth element, there should be, you know, space, everything has to be there. And these are also causes, because if one of them are not present, it would not happen. So they are, you know, it's simultaneously there. And then there are also causes which are like dependent causes. Like, you know, if you have to have a house, you have to build a house, then you have the pillar, but you also have the beam. And they are, you know, they are cause of the house, because without that you can't have house. So they, you know. And also then there are, of course, there are also causes like good deeds bring good results and things like that. But there are also another cause which is like, you know, if you are the immediate, you know, the way you are now, you know, creates the next moment of you which will be similar to the way you are. And this is also a cause. And then there's another cause which is a little bit sometimes strange in a way. But actually anything that doesn't obstruct this thing to happen is also a cause, you know. Because if it was something that was obstructing, it will not let that happen. So anything, everything in the whole universe which doesn't obstruct this thing to happen is also, in a very broad sense, a cause. So therefore, the cause is very, you know. So when you understand this, then you understand the interdependence, how much interdependent everything is. Because if there is one thing which obstructs this, yet I'm here, but you know, if there is one little thing, maybe a cell in me that didn't let me to grow, I wouldn't be here, you know. So therefore anything that is not obstructing me to be here in this way is also indirectly a cause. So therefore, you know, and this is something people need to study very well. And if you are studying like Madhyamika, I think there are some starting to happen, some study groups, they should actually work on this. Then there is another question. From the point of view of, this is from Marlo, from the point of view of motivation, would Rinpoche say that living in the Buddhist community in a monastery, like Lerabling in the West or a monastery in the East, where there might be less room for laziness, even though the life story of Venerable Shantideva in another monastery proved, thus in general more diligence and maybe discipline would be more compassionate here in the free wild West, as Sojourn Rinpoche would call it, there are many distractions and challenges, but also great opportunity to do something valuable directly to transform suffering in something for ourselves and brothers, sisters in society. Well, I don't really know, but you know, because you are in a monastery doesn't mean that you become diligent. It's completely not so. If you want to be lazy, you can be very lazy in the monastery also. And actually, in the monasteries are not that strict after all. So, you know, it's up to us. It's totally up to us. You know, how much we understand, how much we do things, how much we actually take action, that's the more important thing. Not about the monastery. And anyway, something imposed on us We can, you know, it can't work. You know, we have to do it from within ourselves. And then the last question is, does white dhara arise from the sound or the appearance of tam, the syllable? What is the meaning of tam? Is the meaning of tam? So this, I don't know the meaning. There is no meaning of tam. It's just a sound, and a blessed sound, that's all. And it's just, you know, so you can say anything. Actually, there is nothing specific about that. Thank you very much.